The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Good morning, and welcome to today's episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents, originally recorded and broadcast on Saturday, September the 12th, 2026, at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. Today's episode is entitled The Films of Oliver Stone. The time is 8:17 over here in London, England, and it is nice to be presenting new content for you again. Okay, so we'll go straight over to the Oliver Stone Wikipedia page and scroll down to the filmography section. This is the first show in this series on film directors where I'm not going to be covering the full filmography because I haven't watched it all. Apart from the Elvis film by John Carpenter that some people say, actually on his Wikipedia page, it's not part of his actual filmography because it was a television film rather than a feature film. I still regarded it as that, and I gave my reasons not being an Elvis fan and the cost of it to buy as why I didn't watch that. But apart from that, all the other directors that I've covered, Stanley Kubrick, Martin Scorsese, David Cronenberg and David Lynch, I've watched all the films by. And I learned from that experience, and we'll get to that today. So the first eight films on the filmography, this is something else I want to point out. I'm only interested in what they directed. Okay, so there's only three of the first eight that Oliver Stone directed. Now, the first one, Seizure, it says it's a horror film, it's a directorial debut. Wasn't something that interested me. 1981's The Hand again. That stars Michael Caine as a comic book artist who loses his hand, which takes on some murderous form. I might pick it up if I saw it somewhere, but it's not something that I'm... Basically, there are later films in Oliver Stone's filmography. I'm only going to get through just over half of them. And the amount that are there that I'm just not interested in, I had all of those and it was a case of watching these two probably look more interesting to me than the later ones that we'll get to. But apart from Midnight Express in 1978, which he didn't direct, I only mentioned because I have seen it, he was the writer, regarded by many as a classic film, a American drug smuggler, acting alone, he's caught at a Turkish airport and he spends some time in prison there, and it's his story. It's difficult for me to sympathise with the character, and therefore I find the film not that much. I mean, it's not a fun film to watch anyway, watching someone, what they're subjected to in a Turkish prison, but some people like it, so it's something that may interest you. Conan the Barbarian he wrote, which I've heard of, but it didn't interest me. Scarface is a very good film, he actually wrote that. Brian De Palma directed. So that is a very famous film with Al Pacino. Year of the Dragon, 1985, I've not even heard of. He wrote that. And Salvador is the first film of his that I saw as a director. And it stars James Woods, and it's set in the period of unrest in El Salvador, where you've got all sorts of civil war going on and drugs and all sorts of different things. And it's James Woods plays this journalist, and he's a photojournalist, so he goes over there to get pictures of all the atrocities going on and has to get them sent back, and he's a, an unsavoury character himself, you know, womaniser, drinker, and all sorts of things he gets up to. It is a good film. It's really what you would call gritty. And you'll watch it and you know you've seen a good film, but did you really enjoy it? I've got a copy of it. I saw it years ago. I had an ex-rental VHS copy. But I found it on DVD and I watched it. And it is a good film, but it's a rough watch. I wouldn't be going back to it. Similar to 1986's Platoon. Now, Salvador is actually listed as 1986, but it was made in 85. And Platoon is probably Oliver Stone's most successful film. I think it won a great deal of Oscars. And it, for me, Oliver Stone, when I was growing up, he was the director to go to. He was the hip thing. You've got to remember that 1986, I was 12, 13 years old and starting to look at things like films for myself and seeing these posters of things like Platoon. And the other thing that had happened the year before, the song 19 by Paul Hardcastle had come out. And growing up in England, you were told about things like World War One, World War Two, things that involved Britain. And they always seem so distant in the past. I never seem to be that interested in things that are that far back, certainly when I was younger. Well, not that far back, but to me, it kind of, is there anything that happened in my lifetime? And the Vietnam War I first heard about in the Paul Hardcastle song 19, as silly as that sounds. And so I found out about it, asking people, and found out it was a war that went on from the 60s through the 70s, by the United States in Vietnam. So I was very interested, and I think the first film I saw about it was called The Forgotten Parallel. It's also known as Combat Zone. That's quite a good film on the Vietnam War. It's very low budget, but I think it's quite well done. And then Platoon was the first major film. I mean, people argue that Apocalypse Now was a Vietnam film. I think Platoon was more faithful to the subject matter. You've got to bear in mind that Apocalypse Now was based upon the Joseph Conrad novel Hearts of Darkness, okay? So it was taken back and it was put in Vietnam, but the story was something completely different, whereas this really was made, it was about atrocities in Vietnam, so you're talking about things like the My Lai Massacre, things like that. I want to see the awards and nominations section. I mean, it was made for £6 million in 86, it was released. £138.5 million it did at the box office, so that is big, big returns there. It got the Best Picture and the Best Director, Best Film Editing, Best Sound, Best Editing. Oh, no, that's, that goes down to BAFTA. So, and both Tom Berenger and Willem Dafoe were nominated for Best Supporting Actor, and Oliver Stone was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. I believe he already won that for, did he win it for Scarface? I'll go back and look, but I think he won that. And the cinematographer Robert Richardson was also nominated. So let's just, that really sums up the film. I mean, it's a Vietnam film. The funny thing is these days is that I've discovered I'm not really interested in war films, if that makes sense. It's not something that, most recently I saw the film Patton that I never knew. I'd heard of it, George C. Scott, and I know all about Patton. Many people speak very favourably of him. And I never realised that Francis Ford Coppola had done the screenplay for it, but it turned out that he had. And I just found it to be a bit of a boring film, to be honest. It didn't really, as I say, do a great deal for me. It was worth watching, but then again, it's just war films I found generally are not things that I go for these days. But Platoon is a very well-made one, and it says here it was inducted into the National Film Registry in 2019. So again, it's like something that wins an Oscar or gets inducted into the National Film Registry. Something I forgot to mention yesterday on the films of David Lynch is his film Lost Highway it got two thumbs down from Siskel and Ebert, and he said, well, that's two great reasons to see it already, which is quite an amusing comment, although I would say there were three scenes in there I thought were worth watching, and that was about it, so I'm more likely to agree with Siskel and Ebert. But how many films are honoured by the Oscars and they're just no good, you know, or you watch them and so just because it wins the top prize doesn't necessarily make it worth watching. 1987, Wall Street. Now, that was a big film for me. In the UK, this, you've got to bear in mind, this is the time of, you've got the Thatcher era, you've got all these stockbrokers anyway, everywhere, loads of people making money in the mid to late 80s, or all this sort of yuppies was the term. Yeah, we all wanted to be a yuppie at school. Let's leave school and be a yuppie and have a big brick mobile phone and drive a BMW and these sorts of things. Well, Wall Street was all about the clues in the title about the stock market, Wall Street, and it's got an interesting story. Michael Douglas won the Best Actor Oscar for playing the role. He had to fight to get the role. I think people argued, whether it was Oliver Stone himself or people at the studio, they didn't feel he was capable of doing a role like that. The roles that he'd done up to that point were a touch comedic, if you think, Romancing the Stone, The Jewel of the Nile. I think that was... Michael Douglas never appealed to me, one of these sort of fantasy-type children's things, from what I can gather. But basically, it is an entertaining film. I don't want to give spoilers away. Charlie Sheen is the lead actor in it. Martin Sheen also plays his father, his real-life father as well, in the film. And he is a young up-and-coming stockbroker. Michael Douglas plays a guy called Gordon Gekko, who's a legend on the stock market. And Martin Sheen establishes a relationship with Michael Douglas and ends up doing things against his ethics just to satisfy his mentor, the Michael Douglas character. And it's the story of what happens there. It's very entertaining. That takes us to 1988, which for me is Oliver Stone's finest film, Talk Radio, starring Eric Bogosian. And Eric Bogosian, I think, wrote it even, and it was a stage play, and it was, parts of it were based on the book Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg by Stephen Singular, and it is a film about a talk radio host who's very abrasive towards his audience and gets people annoyed, and people are jumping up and down on the phone and getting angry with him and stuff like that, and it's entertaining. And it really is it's a film like no other. I saw it when I was younger. I actually ended up, I think it's the most expensive Blu-ray I bought. It was bought out as part of the Twilight Time collection. And Twilight Time, another film I bought for my mother actually, Lost Horizon, the 1970s version. And what they do is they take a film and they release 3,000 copies worldwide, and then that's it. And so when you find them, if they've been out a while and they're no longer available new, then you can be paying more for them. I think 50 quid for that is a bargain. However, you have to be a bit careful, because I think that Salvador was released on Criterion Collection, not Criterion, let me get it right, Twilight Time Collection, 3,000 units. And it subsequently got released on Blu-ray without any limits by, presumably, the studio that owns it. So if you're buying an investment, there's always a chance that it might get released. So I would only do it for something that you really want to watch. And as I say, it's just an excellent story. I watched it long before I was doing radio myself, but it was always one of my favourite films, and I think it's an exciting story and well worth watching. Let's see how long it is. Just under 2 hours, 1 hour 50 minutes. It's difficult to go through a lot of these without giving you spoilers. 1989 bought the Born on the 4th of July film. Now, this was the second part it became of his Vietnam trilogy, and it focused on a guy called Ron Kovic, who was played by Tom Cruise. And he was in the Vietnam War. He got paralysed. He was confined to a wheelchair after his time there. And he was very upset when he saw people booing the veterans as they came home, the protesters against the Vietnam War in America. But he consequently became an anti-war activist, and it's his story. And it's a very harrowing story, because there are times when he's in a veterans hospital and the conditions in there are far from adequate. And the things he gets up to, I mean, there's a scene that is, it's awful really, but it's comically done. He has a fight with another veteran who's also in a wheelchair, Willem Dafoe. And I mean, Willem Dafoe, what an actor. When you think about him, I'm going to look at his filmography. I've seen him in so many things. He gets these, he's almost like Donald Pleasance, in the sense that Donald Pleasance would get a lot of roles. He'd sometimes do 10, 12 films in a year, doing a little role here, a little role there. He famously would never turn anything down, okay? Willem Dafoe, how many films has he popped up in? And he's generally not a lead. He'll generally pop up as some sort of character actor, but he's always Willem Dafoe, but he's always a joy to watch. They're having a fight in their wheelchairs and stuff, him and Tom Cruise. And there are some really horrible scenes in it. Tom Cruise is trying to walk again. He falls over, gets a compound fracture and things like that. Always unpleasant to look at. But it's an excellent character study. And it takes the film Platoon from, you know, the actual fighting side of things, as it were, to the aftermath. Then we've got 1991's The Doors. It's the next film. Now, at the time, I just started getting into things like The Doors, you know. Start off with The Beatles and The Rolling Stones, and oh, let's do The Doors. Everyone's talking about The Doors. And it just happened that the film came out at a similar time that I was getting into it. I was 18 years old, probably then. Just off to university. In fact, I had a friend there who was living in the halls of residence, and he had two passions in life, and that was Leeds United Football Club, that he was an avid supporter of, who would go on to win the final Division One title that year before it became the Premier League, and The Doors, and he was a fan of both. Excuse me. So, anyway, I looked at the film recently. Picked up a copy of the charity shop for £1. It can be quite expensive. I remember looking it up online. It was sort of getting on for £20 in certain cases, but you might look it up now and it might be a fiver. As I say, these things can fluctuate wildly when you're looking on some of the auction sites. Val Kilmer plays Jim Morrison. I think he looks very much like him. I think he does a good job. But what Oliver Stone said he was also trying to do was he tried to embody the 60s feel in there. And I watched it only earlier this year, and I probably last saw it when it came out, you know what I mean? And so an 18-year-old looking at it, and now a 53-year-old looking at it. And I think when I was younger, I probably admired the conduct of a Jim Morrison, and, you know, trying to be as rude as he could on stage and drinking and doing what he wants and womanising and all that sort of thing. As a 53-year-old, I just look at the guy as a bit pathetic, to be quite frank. So it shows how you look at things in different ways, the age that you are. And it was worth watching, and it's definitely a well-done film on the both The Doors and Jim Morrison. I mean, there's an interesting bit where it shows how they came up with the Light My Fire song, because this was one of the few that Jim Morrison, I don't believe, did the lyrics for. So if you're a fan, I would certainly recommend watching it. JFK. Now, when this film came out, I was so excited, because from a young age, I was always, from the age of, I think I got my first sort of UFO book when I was 6-7 years old, and then I was getting the ghost books and all these different things, anything a bit weird. And I heard stories about how some people claim JFK was still alive, and, you know, he was seen in a wheelchair in a hospital, and all these different stories that are probably old wives' tales that have been regurgitated down the line. So to actually see a film that was going to question the official narrative of the JFK assassination, I think it was, I was lucky, because I question the official narrative of the JFK assassination, but my conclusions are very different to the ones arrived at by Oliver Stone in that film. Fortunately, I hadn't done my own research. It would be many years until I had after watching this film. And so I was able to see it and really appreciate it. And it is very well done. And again, it's got a real amazing acting lineup. You've got Kevin Costner in there. You've got Kevin Bacon, Gary Oldman. I mean, let me click on it because I'm just going to miss names. But it's almost like, it reminded me that the lineup here, very similar to what would happen with True Romance a couple of years later in 1993. Everyone seemed to want to be in it. So Tommy Lee Jones, Joe Pesci, Donald Sutherland, Lauren Metcalf, and a narration by Martin Sheen. Let's see how it did at the box office. It was made with a $40 million budget, made $205 million. So it was a success as well. And it was an interesting film, and it was a lengthy film, over 3 hours, but well worth watching. Now I struggle to watch it because, as I say, my conclusions as to who was really behind the assassination differ from Oliver Stone's, but nonetheless a great film. 1993's Heaven and Earth. This is supposed to be the conclusion of Oliver Stone's Vietnam trilogy. Now, I picked this up in a charity shop this year. It was £1. It was in my hand. And I'd already decided there were other Oliver Stone films I didn't wish to see. And so I looked at this, and basically, it says the film was based on the books When Heaven and Earth Change Places and Child of War, Woman of Peace, both authored by Lili Hayslip about her experiences during and after the Vietnam War. And I believe she ends up in a romantic relationship with Tommy Lee Jones, who, I don't know if he's an ex-soldier or something like that. I looked at it, it didn't interest me, so I can't tell you a great deal about it, but it does conclude the other two films. If you want to conclude them with this, by all means, go ahead. Let's see if budget $33 million, box office just under $6 million, so it was a real bomb there. It says Heaven and Earth received mixed reviews in contrast to Stone's previous two Vietnam films. The review aggregator, Rotten Tomatoes, giving it 45%. The site's consensus states Heaven and Earth is a well-intentioned glimpse into an underrepresentative perspective on Vietnam, but Oliver Stone's solemn storytelling keeps audiences at a fatal distance from Hip Thee Lee's enigmatic heroine. But Roger Ebert seemed to like it. He gave it 3.5 stars out of a possible 4, praising the film for focusing on a woman's perspective and adding how Stone loves big subjects and approaches them fearlessly. There you go. Okay, so we're getting towards the end of the ones I watched. 1994's Natural Born Killers. Now, this is a close, it's almost a tie for my favourite Oliver Stone film with Talk Radio. It was a Quentin Tarantino script. It was changed to such an extent that Quentin Tarantino, I believe, disowned it or asked himself to be removed from the credits, something like that. And essentially, I feel that it was just, from a stylistic point of view, you get these scenes where suddenly animation takes over, and I've never seen a film like it. If someone told me about this, oh, there's a lot of animation in this film, I'd be like, why would I want to see that? But it really is an amazing technical film. And the story, you've got a man and a woman, Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis, both from dysfunctional family background, and they end up going on a killing spree across America. Sounds very unsavory. They are caught, they're put on trial, and well, the tagline for the film is the media made them superstars, and it's how the media can, there's a media guy played brilliantly here by Robert Downey Jr. in the film. Tommy Lee Jones is in it as a prison warden. There's so many good performances in the film. And at the same time, it is an entertaining film to watch. So from my point of view, I don't want to give too much away. What's the other people in there? Rodney Dangerfield does a very, very creepy, and it's one of these things that you don't want to laugh, but you do. A portrayal of Juliette Lewis's father. Tom Sizemore is the other actor that really stuck out for me. There's an excellent dialogue between him as a detective who caught Mickey and Mallory, who are the killers in the film, and he's having a conversation with the warden of the prison that they're in, Dwight McCluskey, played by Tommy Lee Jones. And Tommy Lee Jones says to him, he says, so how do you get into, because he's got a book called Scagnetti on Scagnetti, so he's a detective who's written about his own work, and he's obviously quite full of himself. And Tommy Lee Jones says, how do you get into, you know, this line of business and all that? And he says, well, I recommend having your mother killed by a serial killer. And it turns out that his mother in the story was killed by Walt Whitman. And it's just entertaining all the way throughout. And I found it to be an exciting film that I would go back to. I've just noticed that Jared Harris is in it as London Boy, which I've never noticed before. So again, that's the story of this film. And I think that when it comes to Quentin Tarantino's work, this is probably the best adaptation of his work, and then True Romance follows that by Tony Scott, but only shortly behind. It's a very good film as well. Okay, so let's move on to Nixon, which is another film that cost me, I think, £30 I paid for it on Blu-ray secondhand, a very rare Blu-ray. I don't believe it's on Twilight Time or anything like that. It just had some sort of limited release, and I'd seen it many years ago. Anthony Hopkins plays Nixon, and Paul Savino plays Henry Kissinger, and he does it really well. You actually think, you know, Paul Savino, you associate him with obviously the big Paulie character in Goodfellas, but he does a very good job. And it's a biopic of Nixon, and it can be quite sympathetic towards him in places. I found it to be worth watching. The other interesting parts in it is James Woods pops up again. As is it Haldeman? Is he? Yeah, I got it right. H.R. Haldeman. And J.T. Watt, which is obviously one of was Nixon's closest advisor. And another advisor, J.T. Walsh. He's another great character actor. That, not to be confused by M. Emmett Walsh, but whenever they pop up in films, they play small character actor roles, both very, very well. I don't believe that they're related. So, best way to describe it is it covers elements of Nixon's time in the White House and his demise at the end. It actually makes it quite sympathetic. So, and Anthony Hopkins, has he ever acted badly in a film? I mean, he's been in bad films. I've got a film I saw recently called Right, spelled R-I-T-E. And his performance is excellent in it. It's just the film's not very good, you know? So let's go back to you've got Evita that he didn't direct. Even if he had have done, I wouldn't be watching that. And then you've got U-Turn, which is a very, you know, when you have all these stories that he filmed that are based on true stories, you know, starting with Salvador, Platoon, Talk Radio, Born on the 4th of July, The Doors, JFK. The only one out of there, I mean, Wall Street is, there's a sort of crash in the film, but I believe the crash happened later than when the film came out. But so it was certainly fortuitous if it wasn't when the film came out and it incorporated that into it. So you could argue that's biographical too. And so therefore the only non-biographical thing so far that he's directed is Natural Born Killers. So you could say he continued in the same vein with U-Turn, which starred Sean Penn, Billy Bob Thornton, Jennifer Lopez, John Voight. Nick Nolte plays a memorable role, and there's some guy who ends up in a town, his car breaks down and he just can't seem to get out of the town. Everything goes wrong left, right and centre. It's like a farce. I spent a long time trying to find it again in a charity shop, and when I finally found it, I was really pleased, and I watched it and I was quite underwhelmed by the story, to be honest with you. I think I've summed it up as best I can. There's some entertaining bits in it, but it's nowhere near the quality of the previous work that I'd seen by Oliver Stone. So this takes us to 1999's Any Given Sunday and 2004's Alexander, 2008's W, and these three films. Right, Any Given Sunday is about American football, which wouldn't interest me. Alexander is about King Alexander the Great, which doesn't interest me. And W is a biopic of George W. Bush. Now, I'm happy to watch a biopic of Nixon, but I have such a problem with George W. Bush. Even I understand it was a comedy or had comedic aspects to it, but I don't want that guy's life made a comedy. I'll give you an example. There was a woman who, when he was governor of Texas, she was on death row there. And while she was in the prison, she'd become a model citizen. She was a Christian. She helped other prisoners and stuff like that. And he was interviewed about, he was asked for clemency even by the governor of the prison because this woman had really turned her life around. And he did, not only did he not give her clemency, but he joked about it. He said, oh, she said, please don't kill me, please don't kill me. And he laughed. He thought it was funny. You know who he did give clemency to? Henry Lee Lucas. He commuted his death sentence to life imprisonment. What does that tell you? So I've got to stop there because I don't want to get political. But George W. Bush absolutely disgusts me. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more serious things that I believe he's involved with that are a lot worse than that. But so I wanted to go through those films quickly just to say I would never want to watch any of those films. And this is why I haven't watched other films that I might consider, because I'm not going to complete the filmography. And whilst a couple of these early films that I mentioned, the seizure one, the horror film, and The Hand, which seems to be horror as well, I'm not planning to look this up on auction site to buy it. It might not have even had a DVD release, but if I saw it in a charity shop or a car boot sale, I would pick it up and see what it was like. And I base another part of that on I'm pleased that I completed the filmographies of the other directors in this series. But apart from Memoirs of an Invisible Man, which I never thought I'd enjoy, the John Carpenter film starring Chevy Chase and Daryl Hannah, the ones that I chose not to get because I didn't think I would be interested in them, I was proven right, because I wasn't interested in them. I just ended up watching them in order to complete the filmography. Okay, so we'll go back to World Trade Center, which is in the middle of these Any Given Sunday, Alexander. Well, let me say, Any Given Sunday is 1999, following U-Turn from 1997. Then we've got a five-year break till Alexander in 2004. Then we've got 2006 World Trade Center. Now, this was something I didn't want to watch because I thought his interpretation of what happened with JFK, he agrees that the government story is not accurate, but I don't agree with his alternative view. And I felt that his interpretation of World Trade Center would be something similar. So I never even bothered looking the film up, but I was in a charity shop and there was a copy of the film there. So I picked it up and it turns out it's actually about a firefighter crew, I believe, on the day of the attacks in the World Trade Center and how they were trapped in there and they managed to get out. And I watched it. It was okay, but I ended up getting rid of it. It wasn't something that I was that interested in. I mean, it's a wonderful tale of heroism, and it's great that these people survived such a horrific event, but it wasn't something that I was that interested in. 2008 is W that I said. And then we've got 2010, the sequel to Wall Street, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. So 23 years on from the original with Michael Douglas. And Michael Douglas really has aged in this, and that's 16 years ago now. It was okay to watch, but like many sequels, if you've liked an original, you almost feel duty-bound to watch the sequel. But having watched it, and he's got an irritating daughter in there, and And there were bits that were filmed in London. Certainly they were set there. Whether they were filmed on a set, you know, very well, it looked like it had actually been filmed in London, but it certainly seemed to be. And if I had the choice of the film existing or not existing, I prefer it not to exist. Not that it tarnishes the original, but because I like the original so much, I felt I had to watch this. But it's not, I'll keep it, but it's not something I think I'll be going back to again. And that takes us to 2012 Savages. So let's see what that's all about. It says, I'm going to have to click on the page, I'm afraid. Oh, yeah. Best friends, Chon and Ben, are cannabis growers in Laguna Beach. Chon, a former naval SEAL, smuggled the seeds for the plants out of Afghanistan. Ben, a University of California, Berkeley graduate in business and botany, cultivates cannabis. Chon and Ben become wealthy. And I'm not interested in lead characters growing drugs. I mean, there's exceptions. I mean, Breaking Bad is a great series, but something like this, the actors in it as well, I mean, I don't recognise any of their names. Benicio del Toro, I recognise, and John Travolta's apparently in it, who's not, never been one of my favourites. I mean, what a career disaster. John Travolta appeared in Pulp Fiction. You know, was supposed to get that role. It was actually written for Michael Madsen. But he decided to do Thelma and Louise instead. You imagine what Michael Madsen's career could have been if he'd have played the John Travolta role part in Pulp Fiction. And John Travolta's career, I mean, a lot of people, I thought it was on the slide, but Tim Roth said in one of the extras on Pulp Fiction that, don't forget, he was one of the voices in Look Who's Talking, and those films would not interest me, but they were huge box office hits. So let's go over to the film after that. Snowden, Edward Snowden, the so-called NSA whistleblower. Very much like, who was the guy that we had in WikiLeaks guy? Julian Assange. I believe the government tells lies, okay? And as I say, I can't get political on this show. But these two people are sort of, they're put out there as the standard bearers for whistleblowing. And they don't come out with much of the information I've learned. And I always ask the question, you know, they've got a lot more backing than me, you know. So how come they haven't found things out, they don't talk about things that I've talked about, that the government are involved in? And that makes me question if they're genuine or not. I mean, Julian Assange obviously was in prison in this country for many, many years, so you have to ask, how do you square that circle? Well, my answer is I don't know. But I also don't know how somebody with the resources of a Julian Assange can't find out some of the information I found out and broadcast that to the public, as he was with so much other information from WikiLeaks. So Snowden's 2016, and then White Lies is a film coming up. So it says TBA, and it stars Josh Hartnett. I didn't know that guy. Didn't he pop up in Halloween H2O? I don't remember what he's done since. I don't remember him at all. Willem Dafoe's in it, and Michael Douglas. Oh my! I remember I said he looked old in Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, and I remember talking to a friend about the film 2012, which was a great, great disaster film, and the fact that you kind of, it was released just before these Mayan prophecies about the world ending in 2012. You start to think, you know, could this be? Is this going to happen type of thing? So it added to it more than, say, The Day After Tomorrow by the same director. And I said to him that Danny Glover plays the president in the film. I think it was made about 2007, 2008, maybe 2010. And I said, he looks quite old. He says, it looks quite old. He said, Lethal Weapon was 1987. He looked old in that, but he was still going. So anyway, there you go. I think I first saw him, he popped up in a Hill Street Blues episode as a guest star. So that was probably near the start of his career. So White Lies is an upcoming film. Does it say anything about... Benicio Del Toro exited the project by March 2026, with Josh Hartnett replacing him. Filming concluded in June of 2026, so as I said with the Martin Scorsese film coming up, I think it's called What Happens at Night, if you base that between filming and release on Killers of the Flower Moon, it took 2 years between filming, wrapping and the actual release. So we'll see how long White Lies takes. It's his first film if it's done quickly and comes out this year. I mean, it wrapped in June, so it's possible. I know Halloween 4, they had to rush it through. I think they only started developing it in March or something of the year it was released, just before Halloween. So it is possible. We'll just have to see. But if he releases it this year, it'll be 10 years since his last film, Oliver Stone. Premise, a story tracing through three generations that portrays a child of divorce now repeating his parents' mistakes in his own marriage and with his troubled son. Feeling trapped, he embarks on a lust-filled journey to free himself, but only becomes more lost. When he meets a woman whose life is the opposite of his own, he begins a journey of rediscovery. I don't think I'll be seeing that. Okay, so that rounds us off with the Oliver Stone limited filmography this time, but it gave me ideas because there were other things that I thought I would cover. There were other directors that I thought I would cover in this series, but they suffer from the same films that I'm not interested in, that, you know, you have to be subjective. Some of the films I haven't even watched might be some people's favorite work of Oliver Stone, but I can only tell you what I feel when I watch something, or what I feel as to why I don't. But I've got three other directors I'm going to go through very quickly. And rather than tell you the films of theirs that I don't like and why I haven't watched them or whatever, I'm just going to tell you the amount of films that they did and the amount of films of theirs that I like. So we're going to start off with the Coen brothers. Now, you go to their Wikipedia page, obviously, filmography section again. They did 18 films. Now, I think I like about five of them. The first one was their first film, Blood Simple, which is... it's quite a sort of atmospheric film. And you've got a woman in a relationship with her husband, and it's not going well, and... you know, she's looking for a way out. You've got a hitman played by M. Emmett Walsh, who really makes the film. He wears this ridiculous outfit with a cowboy hat, and he carries around this lighter, which a Zippo lighter that he's got Man of the Year engraved on the side, you know, of course, meaning him. And he's in some great scenes in the film, and I believe he this was the Coen brothers' first film, and he was really helping them out to make the film, to help, you know, young filmmakers and things like that. So people call it film noir, which I don't generally like, but it is a good film and it's entertaining to watch. The next one is 1990's Miller's Crossing. Now, that is like a mafia type film. It stars Gabriel Byrne, John Turturro, John Polito and Albert Finney. It says it concerns a power struggle between two rival gangs and how the protagonist, Tom Reagan, plays both sides against each other. And Tom Reagan is, of course, played by Gabriel Byrne. But it is an interesting film. There are other people pop up. I see Steve Buscemi pops up in there, as he does in quite a few of the Coen brothers' films. Then we go over to 1996's Fargo. This is a classic film. It really is well done, and it's up there as one of their best. But there are twists in it, and even got a film, a television series based on it, which had a couple of good seasons, I thought, and then went off, and I didn't bother after the Ewan McGregor season of the television series. I jumped out then. I didn't like that, to be quite honest. The first two seemed to be quite good. So anyway, it's a beautiful setting because this town of Fargo, there's snow everywhere, and the people, I think that they come from some sort of a Scandinavian descent, and they have a certain accent way of talking. Frances McDormand is the lead role. William H. Macy is in it. Steve Buscemi again. And it's a big... it's a guy's life going wrong, and he tries these different things to save himself from bankruptcy and what have you, and it couldn't go more wrong, okay? What he ends up getting involved with to try and get himself out of trouble, he just gets into more trouble than he could ever have imagined. And it is, if you've never seen it, you're in for a treat. But I've not seen it that often because the enjoyment is in the surprises that you get. So I urge you not to read up on it before you watch it, because yesterday I looked up a Law and Order actress that had just joined the series, because I like to look them up and what's their background, and it said on the page I looked at that they die, that they get murdered at the end of the following series. I thought, oh, great, I would have been worth watching that, but now I know it's coming up. Excuse me, I ruined it for myself. That takes us to 1998's The Big Lebowski. This is a joy to watch. It's Jeff Bridges. I struggled recalling his name as well before, but he's such a great actor. John Goodman, Julianne Moore, Steve Buscemi. I think even the actor David Thewlis pops up in a small role out of the film Naked, which is the only Mike Leigh film I've ever enjoyed, and he does a fantastic performance in that film as a guy on the streets of London. But how do you describe it? It's like a, well, it's described as a neo-noir crime comedy film. It's just so enjoyable. You've got this slacker, if you want to call him that, but you do like him, played by Jeff Bridges. And all he wants to do is listen to Creedence Clearwater Revival tapes and go bowling with his friends. And he gets misidentified as someone else. And all these things happen to him in his life, people coming after him, because he's called... let me see if I get this right. I think he's the guy that is Jeffrey the Dude Lebowski, and he's mistaken for another Lebowski. And he has to solve what's going on because people are coming after him. He's the wrong guy. So the only way to sort it out is find out who is this Lebowski that these people are after so I can get him off my back. And it's just such a well-done film. It's a real cult classic. And again, I would really recommend this. This is probably their best film, with Fargo as a close second. And that takes us all the way down to the last film of them that I was interested in. I have seen some others that I didn't like, but I'm not going to go into. And there are others that I didn't see. I did buy... there's a big box set of theirs, I think, with about 8 of their films in. It's in a yellow box. And the films in there, I just couldn't get on with. And I'd looked at others in the past, and I was not really interested in the subject matter. And then I end up seeing some of the ones in the box set and I just fast-forwarded through. They just weren't for me. But No Country for Old Men, which starred Tommy Lee Jones, it's based on a book by Cormac McCarthy. And it is like a crime film. And there's a sort of big body count in it and all sorts of stuff. The problem I found with it was that it... Tommy Lee Jones's, the accents of some of the people in there, I found very difficult to understand. I think people in America, they find the Cockney accent out of London difficult to understand. But this, I think, was out of Texas, the accent. I just, you know, almost getting to the stage of having to put subtitles up to understand what Tommy Lee Jones was saying. It says here on the Wikipedia page, No Country for Old Men is regarded by many as the Coen Brothers' magnum opus. And it did, I think it got a lot of awards. So let me see here. Winning 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. So it got the Best Picture that year. It's something I will look at again. And it's really a crime drama. with some, you know, excellent performances by the people in there. I just wish I understood what Tommy Lee Jones was saying. So that's it for the Coen brothers. They're the films that I liked out of the 20 of the 18 in their filmography. So we'll move on from them to Francis Ford Coppola. Now, Francis Ford Coppola, you can find the first film of his, Dementia 13. It's out of copyright, so you can find it on YouTube. It was made in 1963, and it's a Roger Corman film that he directed. And it's filmed in Ireland, so he must have had a great trip there when he was a young man, getting the chance to go over to Ireland and film at some sort of manor house there. And it's sort of like a ghost-type story, I guess. Didn't do a lot for me. I was pleased to see it, to say that I saw Francis Ford Coppola's first film, and I was planning to see all the rest of his films. As I say, there are 23. But there are just too many that I've seen and didn't like, and that I read up on and I have no interest in. So he's another person that I'm not going to finish the filmography of. The Godfather, let's put them all together. You've got Godfather 1 is 1972, Godfather 2 is 1974, Godfather 3 is 1990. They come in a box set now, and he does an audio commentary on each film. And his audio commentaries on the Godfather films are probably the best audio commentaries I've ever heard by a director on film. They're really good, they're really interesting. There's not really a lot to tell you about the Godfather films, really. You've got a guy who runs a mafia family. That's Marlon Brando in the first one. Hands over to his son, Al Pacino, who is boss in the second and the third. And the second, a lot of people, it's got mafia stuff in it. It's got shootouts, it's got violence, it's got family business, all this sort of stuff. They are classics. If you've not seen them and you're interested in the genre, you really are missing out. One thing that many people say is The Godfather Part 3 was a real letdown. And I felt that. But when you see it after time, it has aged well. And you have to say to yourself, where do you want the Al Pacino character to go 16 years after The Godfather Part 2? Where should he really be going? What is it that you want him to be doing? And what he's actually involved in trying to legitimise his business in Godfather Part 3 really fits even the motivation he says to his wife Kay in Godfather Part 2, that they're going to be legitimate within so many years, and they're not, and he said it's taking longer. So it's still, the narrative is continued. It did miss Robert Duvall's character in there, and apparently he wanted to be paid the same amount of money as Al Pacino, and the studio refused, so his character was killed off, and Consigliere was played by Guy Hamilton, I believe, the guy who's always got a suntan all the time of the year. And it is a good film. The other film that I've seen in that era, so we'll go now chronologically, 1974's The Conversation. Now, this is regarded as a classic, and it's Gene Hackman and John Cazale, and even Harrison Ford pops up in it. Gene Hackman is a guy who's known for bugging people. He's like an expert in his field, and he meets other people in the field and they're like, how did you pull that off? How do you bug that guy? He's a very secretive, reclusive guy. And I just found the film boring. But again, you have to think to yourself, this is 52 years old. Okay, so nothing like this may have been done at the time, so it was really amazing of its time. But I found that all the things you have to go through to get to an ending in which he discovers that something that someone said on a tape, the way that a one word is inflected can make it mean the opposite of what he thought happened. So the way you might say a phrase, if you put the inflection on one word, it makes it the opposite of what the phrase would normally be interpreted as meaning. I'm going to leave it at that. It's in the filmography, the Wikipedia page on The Conversation has the phrase in, it has that in the plot. So if you want to look it up, you can, but I don't want to ruin it for anybody who wants to watch it. But I had a excellent book that I wish I kept. I looked at buying it again, but people are like £12-15 for like a 18-20 page booklet. It came with the Premiere magazine, film magazine, in I think the early 1990s in the UK. It was called The Best Films of the 70s. And I think it had about 20 films in there. And one of them was The Conversation. So a lot of people still regard that very highly. 1979's Apocalypse Now. Again, what can you say about Apocalypse Now? A very well done film. It's come out in different versions. You've got the Redux version that includes this scene where there's a French family who live in that area and don't want to move because even though there's war in the area because they've been there for so long. The film essentially, for those of you who don't know, Martin Sheen plays a American soldier who is sent on a secret mission to take out an American, I think he's a general, major general, something like that, played by Marlon Brando, who's commanding troops in a remote area and has apparently gone insane. And so he needs to go there and relieve him of his command. And it's what happens on his journey to, during a war-torn area. So, of course, he's on a boat, comes under attack. He stops up for supplies and you see what goes on and the supply camps and all things like that. It's very interesting. Robert Duvall plays an amazing role of a soldier who is Mr. Gung-Ho, you know, that line, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, that's who it comes from, that role. Went on, I think, to win the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for that role. It is a classic film. There's more, the things that went on during the making of it, one thing that always disturbed me is Francis Ford Coppola talked about Apocalypse Now. He said, it's not about Vietnam, it is Vietnam, it's what it was really like. And he was trying to equate all the problems he had with filming. One minute he'd be filming helicopters and then they'd be taken away from him because the government needed them to fight insurgents in some part of the country. And I felt he was cheapening the deaths of people in the Vietnam War, trying to equate the filming of Apocalypse Now to what people in the Vietnam War went through. I always felt uncomfortable about that remark. He does the a commentary on it, but I think you have to get the Redux box set to get the commentary. It's interesting, but it's not as good as the Godfather one. That takes us on to Rumblefish. I saw it's 1983. It's a young film about young people. It's all filmed in black and white. I think if you were young when you watched it, it might be exciting, but as a 53-year-old, you saw it earlier in the year, I couldn't wait for it to finish. And I think I'm pretty much going to leave it there. I'll touch on Bram Stoker's Dracula, 1992. I thought that was it was a good adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, but I'm not a big fan of vampire films. My main delight in that was I think the internet was around then, but if you went to remote places or stuff like that, you could sort of get it, like you have to be in the library or something. It wasn't something you had at home. So I was walking down a high street where I was at university, and I saw the cinema and it had Bram Stoker's Dracula and it had the lead actor at the top, Gary Oldman. And I was just delighted because Gary Oldman had got a lead role and found it was a Francis Ford Coppola film. I thought, wow, he really has arrived in America. I think State of Grace, his first American film, was only 3 years before. So I was pleased to see that he'd had some success getting that film. But, it's 92, isn't it, Dracula? So only a couple of years after that. But the film itself, Anthony Hopkins pops up in there again. Keanu Reeves plays his first sort of non-comedic role. And it's amazing to think that the guy who did Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure would go on to be the action hero he became out of things like The Matrix and John Wick and stuff like that. But then again, Bruce Willis, I mean, he started off with some Moonlighting. I think that was a comedy. I never saw any episodes of it. And went on to do Die Hard and then become a big action hero himself. So a film I missed out, I'll touch on, 1988's Tucker, The Man and His Dream. Not only did Francis Ford Coppola film that, but George Lucas had some involvement as well, you know, the guy famous for Star Wars. So you'd think that the end result would be good. Well, it's a well-shot movie. It's just about a guy who tried to build a range of cars to rival Ford and General Motors, and, you know, dirty tricks by his competitors put him out of business before he started. But it's really not a lot happens in it. And so it's like watching a sort of non-story. The guy tries to get his car built. In the end, he gets a few of them built and goes out of business, and that's that. And I don't think that's worthy of making a film about. So, and finally, 1997's The Rainmaker, which is a John Grisham novel that has been filmed by Francis Ford Coppola. I'm not going to get into the ins and outs of it. It is regarded as one of the best adaptations of the of a John Grisham novel. It is an entertaining film. It's a courthouse drama type of thing, but it starts off with the lawyer finding someone who's been hurt by a particular company and goes on to sue them, and, you know, he's against all the odds, but you know how the story goes. I saw it years ago and pretty much forgot about it, and I saw it again earlier this year, and it is a good watch, and I've retained it, and see if I see it in another 20 years when I've forgotten about it again. And that's pretty much all the films of his that I've either seen or want to mention. The others I haven't seen, or I don't think, for me, I didn't enjoy. So that's not a lot out of the 23, but it's more than the two out of the 36 of Steven Spielberg. Now, Steven Spielberg, the reason I mention him, I'm not a fan. The reason I mention him is because he is the record-breaking film director of all time. His films have grossed over $11 billion in total. So he's regarded, certainly on paper, as the most successful film director ever. And I feel that I should touch upon him as I'm touching upon these other two that I thought I'd end up devoting programmes to. So the two films are 1971's Duel, which is a fantastic film. And I thought it was its first, but it turns out he did something in 1964 called Firelight. So he was only 17 when he did that. But Duel, you've got a guy, looks like he's a travelling salesman or something. He's driving across America and he's being chased by this truck and, you know, trying to run him off the road, all sorts of stuff. And it's really scary. And it's funny because Steven Spielberg was talking about how they went round from junkyard to try and find the truck that looked the most menacing, you know what I mean? And they certainly work with what they got there. And that's very simple to describe, in the same way as 1975's Jaws is very simple to describe. And that is, you know, people being chased around by a shark. But a real exercise in suspense and fake scares. And just an excellent film that you can go back to again and again and again. And these, for me, were the two films that I like from Steven Spielberg, and they're the only ones of his that I own. And there are others that I've seen, most of them when I was a child, that I regard as children's films. And there are others that most of his I haven't seen. He doesn't really make films that are of that great an interest to me. And apart from those two, the ones that I have, I've chosen not to keep copies of. Okay, so I think that's everything that I plan to cover. So let me go back to a little script that I wrote for today's show so I don't miss anything. Okay, so now whilst this is the last The Films Of show, I will be including a short of The Films Of section in my Wednesday Current Affairs show entitled I'm Talking To You, in which I will focus on a particular actor each week. So I hope you will join me there. The Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents show will continue, but I will be covering different topics. Also, I only offer my last 20 broadcasts available for download on my website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, and as the first part of this series, The Films of Stanley Kubrick, is now sixth from the bottom of the homepage. It will drop off the website in 6 days, as I publish a broadcast every day. So, if you want to have your own copy of the complete series, all 6 episodes, I urge you to download all the episodes whilst they are still available. And finally, I want to dedicate this six-part The Films Of series to my friend, the late, great Rick Adams, who, unbeknownst to me, was a huge film buff. Indeed, according to his obituary, the link to which is available for the post for this show at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, it states, and I quote, "He was also known as Mr. Movie and was a real man. His film collection is endless, consisting of over 4,000 titles. He projected his personality well through his love of the film industry, both past and present." Well, you kept that quiet, Rick. I will always know you as one of the finest broadcasters out there, who I was privileged to become friends with. And you all know Rick too, for the disclaimer he reads that I broadcast at the start of every ACH show. What I presented to you today is not the subject I'm best known for, but after having had my God-given right to free speech stolen from me by the very people who are supposed to protect it, it has been a joy to be able to speak freely on this subject today. It is not until I did it that I realised how much I missed it. If you enjoyed this episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents and have the financial wherewithal to do so, then please support the show by clicking the blue donate button at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. The more donations I get, the more shows you get. And in the meantime, thank you for listening, and bye for now.